Greetings, warriors, veterans, and America-loving citizens from sea to shining sea. Welcome to Frontlines of Freedom. I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. Hoo-ah! The Frontlines of Freedom team really appreciate you joining us this fine day in America. We are proud Americans. Here's the halfway this hour. We're going to start by talking with Robert Thomas from Operation Homefront about the month of the military child. Then we'll review the movie of the month with Diane Raver, the battle of the month with General Chris Petty, and of course, we'll conclude with military history and our self-defense report. So it's a pleasure to introduce Robert Thomas from Operation Homefront. You may not know it, but April is the month of the military child, and that's going to be our focus. So welcome, Robert. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation.
Bob, tell us about your background. When and where did you serve?
Well, I started out as a military kid. My dad was an Air Force pilot, so when I turned 18, I wanted to be just like my dad. So I headed off to the Air Force Academy, and 31 years later, I left active duty in my mid-50s. Like many of you out there, I had a ton of different assignments. I ended up as a pilot also flying C-141, C-5s, KC-135s. And I just loved my time in the service. And finally, I just got too old and they said, hey, you know, Bob, it's time to move on. Let the young guys take over.
Isn't it strange how they do that? You know, my baby boy just turned 51. How do they get older and we don't?
Yeah, I don't know. And I don't feel that old, but the A1 types told me I was.
And how could they be wrong? Okay. April is the month of the military child. What happens during April? How'd that come? You were a military child as well as a military guy. Talk to us about it.
Well, the month of military child brings the spotlight on military children. And as a lot of our listeners out there know, because they were a military child or they have children and they're in the military, the children serve alongside mom or dad that wears the uniform to work every day. At Operation Homefront, we really want to bring the spotlight on the service and sacrifice of military children. During the month of April, we have a whole host of stories on our website at operationhomefront.org, but really it culminates with our Military Child of the Year banquet, which we hold every April in Washington, D.C. We want to bring that spotlight on all military kids by highlighting a few just spectacular kids, and I mean spectacular, at a banquet attended by many of our service chiefs. This year, we had the Chief Staff of the Air Force, the Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs was there, and a lot of the other service leaders. So it's a wonderful way to highlight the service of our military children and the month of the military child every year.
Well, it is true. Somebody once wrote, I don't remember, but they also serve, will also sit home and wait. And that's the family. When you and I were out putting our lives at risk, being gone, separated, they're the ones that had to live with that, put up with it, and go on with the threat and the risk and the absence. They're serving as well as we did. Certainly, I did that to my family. You obviously did it to yours. You grew up in it. That's not the norm, but everybody involved there is serving our nation. I certainly agree with that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, my little boy, by the time he was in sixth grade, he had been in four different elementary schools. And that's a lot of stress for a young child. And everyone's got those kind of stories. You know, our families in Korea, they're north. They're inside artillery range of the North Koreans. So they absolutely are serving. And so we want to highlight that and recognize their service.
Well, we absolutely want to do that. And reminding everybody about honoring military children in April is one of the things we get to do. Now, this is done by, and you're an agent, I guess the right word, of Operation Homefront. Talk to us about Operation Homefront. What do you do? Who do you do it for? How do you do it?
Well, I am the Chief Operating Officer at Operation Homefront. Our mission is to help build strong, stable, secure military families so they thrive, not just struggle to get by, but thrive in those communities they've worked so hard to protect. You know, our military families have been there for all of us in our nation's time of need. And so we want to be there for them in their time of need. So to accomplish that mission, we have a portfolio of programs, mainly in the relief space and recurring family support areas. In the relief, we do a lot of financial assistance. In fact, this year, we're looking forward to fulfilling our 55,000th request for assistance, and we'll have provided over $40 million in critical relief to military families by the end of the year since that program started. For the kids, this year, we're going to deliver our 550,000th backpack full of school supplies since that program started, saving families over $60 million in back-to-school expenses. Almost every year, we collect more supplies than we need, so we'll gift those out to school districts and other nonprofits in that space. For our holiday meals, This year, we hope to serve our 700,000 individual military family member through our holiday meals for military program, saving families over $9.2 million. All of those recurring family support programs are focused on our junior enlisted families, pay grades E1 to E6. They've got small paychecks. They tend to have young children in the house. And we do not want a military family to be sitting around, around Christmas time, the traditional holiday time, and trying to figure out, hey, am I going to feed my family some kind of special meal for the holidays, or am I going to put presents under the tree? And some of our families have to make those tough decisions. So we want to be there to help out. Back to school time is also a very, very expensive time for families. So we target these programs during certain periods of the year where the families are under a lot of financial stress.
This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. We're talking with Operation Homefront about how they help military families. Bob, I'm very impressed with what you said. One, I know the military families need attention and need assistance, but it is particularly the junior enlisted families that are at the maybe not greater emotional stress, but certainly at the greater point of need for financial and other kind of aid. We have junior enlisted families that have trouble feeding themselves. So therefore, certainly they need care, and I'm glad to know that you guys are there standing with them. That's awesome. Talk about some other things you do.
Well, we're also in the housing space. What we find is that time when you first leave the service is a very turbulent time. I know from my personal experience, it was turbulent. And almost everyone I've talked to has said the same thing. I haven't heard the first person yet that said, hey, it went perfectly smooth. Everything was perfect. There was no financial stress, no issues. I mean, it's a tough time. So we've stood up several programs to address this. Our Permanent Homes for Veterans program, where we partner with big mortgage bankers, mostly using homes that were foreclosed on for one reason or another. But this year, we hope to graduate our 685th family from that program. And when you add up all the equity of those homes, we'll have transferred over $103 million in deeded equity to military families. And that's a life-changing program. It really is. It's gotten smaller over the years because homes are so expensive. We don't get as many donated homes as we used to, but that's a wonderful program. We have a transitional housing village. Those are for families going through the medical discharge process. A lot of those families were planning on staying in the military for an entire career, but there was a training accident or some other form of misfortune, the dreaded, you take your annual physical and doc says, hey, we need to run a few more lab tests.
Yeah.
And then a week later, you're being medically retired unexpectedly. So that allows families to be together while the service member is going through that very difficult time. This year, we hope to provide our 750th family or support our 750th family in that program, saving those families over $8 million in rent and utility costs. Of course, our Transitional Homes for Veterans is one of our newest programs. It's kind of like base housing for those of you who are veterans. We hope to purchase our 40th home this year and graduate our 25th family. And in that program, families stay in these homes for 2 to 3 years. They save money. They work on their credit score. And we want them to be in a financial position to purchase their own home when they graduate from the program. And so far, we've had 22 graduates. 21 have purchased their own home. The 22nd graduate, while he was in the program, he got the calling to go into the seminary. And so when he graduated, he's going to rent because he's going back in the Army as a chaplain in about 18 months.
That's awesome. And we need to encourage people like that. I'm so glad you are doing that. Bob, we're about out of time. How can listeners who want to plug into, learn more about, donate to Operation Homefront, how can they do it?
Well, it's real easy. Just go to operationhomefront.org. You can learn all about Operation Homefront, who the company officers are, who the board of directors are. You can make a donation if you choose to do so, though the majority of people that come to the website are applying for the program. So you can apply for all the housing programs. You can apply for financial assistance, any of the backpack program or the holiday meals program. All of that is right there on the website. And importantly, you can also learn how to be a volunteer. We can't deliver our programs without volunteers. So we're always looking for high quality volunteers, and you can certainly do that. You can get your kids involved. A lot of kids need some volunteer time for that college application. It's a great way to go hand out backpacks or help deliver holiday meals. So operationhomefront.org is all you need to remember on that.
Bob, thank you. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for what you're doing. Thank you for your service to our nation in uniform and now. I'm proud to call you a friend. We need to stay in touch.
All right. Same to you, Dennis. Thank you for the invitation, and thank you for all you're doing.
This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. Next up, we'll review the movie of the month with Diane Raver. Troops, it's time to balance on one foot for 3 minutes, then do the same thing on the other foot. Do this while thinking patriotic thoughts. I'll be right back.
Fellow Americans, we need your help. PatriotFoods.com. We are fighting for the American farmer. U.S. only fruits and vegetables from your soil. Go to PatriotFoods.com. Use your promo code FREEDOM and you get 10% off today. Support your U.S. farmer. Promo code FREEDOM, 10% off. Thank you so much.
It's great food. I eat it. This is Colonel Denny Gillum. PatriotFoods.com. Promo code FREEDOM. I'm Colonel Danny Gillum. Thanks for joining us today on Frontlines of Freedom. And now it's time to review the movie of the month with Diane Raver from the Garden State Film Festival. Welcome, Diane. Glad you're back.
Thank you, Danny. It's always an honor and a privilege to be with you.
Well, we've had a fun, entertaining time since we met how many years ago?
It's five.
Wow.
Almost six, yeah.
That was back when we were young, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I can see why you're so involved with the Garden State Film Festival. The films you find for us are interesting and thoughtful. They're amazing. And you get to deal with many, many more of them. This month's show, The Chinese Tutankhamun.
Tutankhamun.
Yeah. You know, to make an understatement, it shared so many facts about the history of China that it was mind-boggling. We all sort of think that society sort of started out the same way and evolved, and ain't true. They all have their own history. They all did their own thing.
Well, and the other thing is, so much of what happens in today's, you know, world, the politics and all, stems from what a people believe is their, you know, maybe their birthright or their heritage or something from, you know, their culture, which is, of course, in China is, was it, they were as prominent as Egypt, as we think of ancient Egypt. So I'm sure it plays a part in their self-worth, et cetera.
Yeah. And certainly having a little bit of understanding of China is really critical today, since they are
exactly
the biggest threat to the United States and to the whole world. So, yeah. So I think I can see what attracted you to it.
I think it's good to, I mean, this was a documentary. I think it's good to watch the narrative films, but it's also good to get a little information we might not have. Again, our purpose here, our mission is to promote thinking about something. And I think this is something worth thinking about.
Well, it certainly is. And the more we do our own thinking as opposed to considering only what other people tell us, the better off we are and the better off our nation is. Here's a few comments from some listeners. You sort of expect to find some neat stuff in an important person's tomb from way back then, but wow, this was beyond belief. That's a fair statement.
I agree.
I mean, some bodies and maybe a few jewels or whatever, but
a cup, something, you know?
Yeah. The next one was, she was assumed to be a mythical figure and her body laid untouched for 3,000 years and then found in a farmer's field. Wow. Well, I guess it would obviously be hidden somewhere. It would have been not untouched for 3,000 years, right?
So
somehow it ended up in what is now a farmer's field. How that happened is anybody's guess, unless you have some insights.
No, I don't. I also thought it was interesting about finding what they found in the cups, and that the, you know, like in ancient Egypt, when they had the tombs, the guys that were the attendants ended up being put to death too.
Yeah.
In this case, they weren't locals. That I found interesting, that I don't know whether they were slaves or why the people from all different parts of China were the attendants. You know, I found that interesting.
It just shows that everybody has their own culture, their own way of thinking things.
I guess it was conquered people too, you know?
Most likely. But, you know, we'll have to just wonder that one. And she was a priestess, a wife, and a military leader. You know, there have been women who were strong military leaders in the past. I don't know how many of them were priests. this is quite a lady. I mean,
yeah,
she was an extraordinary human being by any standard you want to come up with, which would explain why she was treated with such respect in her burial, right?
Right.
Okay. And 150,000 inscriptions in one tomb, plus all the other bodies that we talked about. That's a lot of inscriptions.
Yeah, that took a lot of care and forethought, too. I mean, the whole thing is amazing.
Well, just designing something big enough to handle 150,000 inscriptions.
Well, you know? There is that.
Yeah. And then doing them. And then who decided what each inscription would... I mean, this had to be a decade or longer effort, I would think, wouldn't you?
Oh, yeah.
And anyway, I'm not asking anybody to do that for me when my time comes.
Oh, come on, Denny.
You know, I settle for, say, 15,000 inscriptions.
Oh, there you go.
Okay, and China was supposed to be more or less isolated until much later, but this leader touched much of Asia and probably beyond Asia. So that the isolated China thing wasn't true, at least.
Not during that time.
Yeah, it wasn't totally true. It may have been in stages, but not then.
I think they said it was pre-dynasty. So maybe the dynasties kind of closed the gates off, you know.
That could be. We'll have to find out. And they invented the horse-drawn war carriage, and they didn't even have native horses. They had to go get horses.
Now, that's amazing.
That's wildly impressive. And it must have been intimidating if you were somebody wanting to fight them. You didn't have horses because there's no native horses, and all of a sudden horses are coming at you pulling war carriages.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy.
And, you know, if she had anything to do with that, she was a good general. And war was a part of society and of life. You know, that was true in a lot of places. I mean, England, before it became England, when it was all the Scotlands and the Welsh, you know, fighting was just a part of life. That's what you did.
Right.
So that's not just there either. So the fact that fighting was a part of life.
Well, I think that goes to human nature too, Denny. People are always trying to take your stuff, whatever it is. You know?
Yes. You know, and tribal societies tended to be that way. Not all of them, but many of them. So in that respect, China's history was very typical of other places. And what impressed me, caught my attention most, was that they drank drinks, basically wine, that had lots of lead in it.
Well, that was from the cup, yeah.
Which was a fatal activity and killed most of them.
Yeah.
Well, wow. I mean,
go figure.
You know, you just don't know. And the message there is stay tuned because things are going to change. They loved and wisely developed the use of bronze. One guy said, I could hear but couldn't see the movie. Not sure why.
Huh.
And the final comment was they found peppercorn in lots of the bodies. Who knew that it was an antibacterial element in peppercorn?
Yeah, I didn't know that.
So those are the comments. This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. We're talking with Diane Raver from the Garden State Film Festival. Well, the film festival for this year is over, but it's coming.
It's rearing its ugly head for next year. The call for anybody who's listening who knows a filmmaker, call for entries opens May 15th and goes till November 1st for 2024. And I want to thank everybody that helped make this last one the big success. We were pre-pandemic attendance, and thank you for all your listeners that just think about supporting us. I appreciate it.
The Garden State Film Festival is an awesome organization activity. If you're all interested, plug in. Diane, thank you for this great film and for being a wonderful member of the Frontlines of Freedom team. I really appreciate you.
Well, we appreciate you and thank you. It's an honor and a privilege.
Coming up next on Frontlines of Freedom, we'll discuss the Battle of the Month with General Chris Petty. Then we'll open our weekly mailbag. This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. Troops, it's time for one-arm push-ups. Just do a dozen with each arm twice. And take a break, but stay in the area. I'll be right back. Friends, there's not too many things I enjoy more than helping veterans and eating great beef jerky. Now I can do both. My good friends at Tango3.org and America's Best Beef Jerky use the highest quality beef to make the best jerky I've ever tasted. Trust me, I've eaten a lot. But that's not all. They give 100% of the profit to vetted veterans programs, mental health and suicide prevention. Go to americasbestbeefjerky.com and order now. And at checkout, check the Front Lines of Freedom promo code.
HelpVet.net was created to be the nation's number one resource center for all veterans, active military, and families. At HelpVet.net, you'll find up-to-date information on benefits available through the VA, resources on education, employment, health and wellness, and more. Find hundreds of nationally recognized organizations offering discounts on products and services, as well as local organizations from attorneys to yoga studios. You'll find them at HelpVet.net. Visit HelpVet.net for all your family's needs.
Welcome back to Frontlines of Freedom. This is Colonel Denny Gillum. Troops, I really do welcome your comments and questions. Contact me through frontlinesoffreedom.com or comment on Facebook. Now it's time for the Battle of the Month with General Chris Petty. The battle of this month is Shiloh, which was fought during our Civil War during April 6th and 7th, am I right, in 1862, right after the war began?
That's right. April 6, 7, 1862, 161 years ago this week.
Wow. Chris, let's start with a quick review of your time in Mother Army.
Okay. Went to West Point like you did, just the younger version of you, and probably a little more handsome and stuff. But did my active duty time. I did all the normal stuff. I branched aviation and did platoon leader and company commander and all that good stuff, and just progressed in assignments and Blue Hueys and Blackhawks for most of my career. Got the distinct honor of commanding a battalion in Iraq during the surge, which was a very difficult time in that war, as you know, and survived that and brought everyone home, which really catapulted me to some other opportunities, which created a brigade command opportunity, which, and then all of a sudden I'm offered a star and being sent to Bosnia to take over a NATO headquarters in Bosnia, which was just fascinating. So, and that led to a couple other things. I got to see a lot of the Army. I got to see the National Guard as well as the active duty. It was just amazing and interesting and fulfilling, and I wouldn't change it for the world.
Hey, I agree with you, bro. I totally agree. Okay, Shiloh. Shiloh was a heck of a fight, and it was early on in the Civil War. Talk to us about it.
Okay, so Shiloh, like we said, April of 62, this is one of the largest battles in the Western theater. I mean, it's the largest one up to this time in the war. It's Major General at the time, Ulysses S. Grant, versus General Albert Sidney Johnston on the Confederate side. And, you know, I like to start with, why should we know this battle? Why should Americans care about Shiloh? Well, first and foremost, it's part of our cultural history. So we have these common things that we should all understand that made us Americans. This is one of them. But more specifically, this is the battle that began to put Ulysses S. Grant on the national stage. It was a big fight. He really was in command for the first time of an army this size. It was about 62,000 Union troops fighting 40,000 Confederate troops. So he's developing as a general officer, and this is a really big part of his education and development in being able to maneuver and fight an army this size. You know, operationally, it further opens up the Tennessee River Valley and directly leads to the Siege of Vicksburg in the fall. So this is a precursor to that. And then one of the other interesting things is this was kind of a wake-up call to the nation of, oh my God, this Civil War is going to be very costly. It's going to last a long time, and it's going to create a lot of carnage. So this was kind of shattering all the views north and south of this might be a quick war. Shiloh did that.
And it is shocking because everybody sort of thought, and I think that just about everybody sort of thought, this would be a quickie. Something would start, and then there'd be some negotiations that would be resolved.
Yeah,
it's a little bit like people were thinking would happen in Ukraine.
Isn't it amazing, Denny, how we always think wars are going to be shorter and simpler than they ever turn out to be?
Uh-huh.
Always. So that's kind of the why it matters. And when you're ready, I'll give you the quick overview.
Well, that's it. I mean, this is a battle that if we understand it, it gives us some insight into wars in general and really insight into the growth of the Civil War. This is really the beginning of the real growth, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And really where the Western theater is like becomes, you know, I don't want to say front and center because it was always all the attention, you know, especially as we look back in history, most people are familiar with the Eastern theater, you know, with what's happening around D.C. and Richmond and all the battles, Gettysburg, et cetera, Antietam, et cetera. People don't really understand the Western theater as much and how important it was, you know, all about rivers and railroads. And, you know, Shiloh is part of that, getting after a railroad junction down in Corinth that the Union forces were trying to get after.
Okay, take us there, bro.
Okay, so Grant has some success in February of 62, taking Forts Donelson and Henry. And so he's kind of opening up the Tennessee River Valley, which the North, the Union understands they have to control the river if they have any hope of choking off the Confederacy. So he's working for Major General Halleck at this time, and he convinces him to push south. And they're going to go after Corinth, like I said, which is a real big railroad junction on the northern border of Mississippi and the southern border of Tennessee. So they're moving forces. General Halleck says, okay, we're going to wait for Major General Don Carlos Buell's army to move to support so we can have, you know, massive numbers of superior numbers to go against Johnston's army. And this is where Grant makes a serious mistake. So he's in a totally offensive mindset. He's moving forces south. He really discounts the Confederates, any kind of offensive mindset. He doesn't do any defensive preparations or anything as he's setting up bivouacs and camps at Pittsburgh Landing. So Johnston actually pulls off a total tactical and operational surprise. So Shiloh opens up on the morning of the 6th of April, with the Union forces being caught completely off guard. They are just being run over. Confederates are charging into literal camps of soldiers cooking breakfasts over campfires. And so the entire Union line is crumbling and moving back. However, some really strong commanders start to create some pockets of real good resistance. The most famous was known as the Hornet's Nest, and I won't go into all the details because we just don't have time. But Johnston ends up getting killed near the Hornet's Nest because he's kind of leading from the front as a Confederate officer, trying to get the momentum back. So Beauregard takes over and, you know, makes some bad tactical decisions. Things start to stall a little bit for the Confederates. In the meantime, Grant is improving the rear position, getting gunboats ready in the river to offer supporting fires as the Union line is still crumbling back. Bottom line is the Union gets their butts kicked on day one and falls back basically to the river, almost the Tennessee River. But on day two, Grant is just an offensive guy. And on day two, he surprises everybody by just letting it go. And everybody does a full out charge. His commanders across the line, and they just push the Confederates back and end up winning the battle because the Confederates were just so spent in terms of physical exhaustion and out of ammunition that he pulls off a great victory and ends up being able to basically walk into Corinth, you know, the following week. So it's quite a battle, and it's quite a part of Grant's education and growth as a general officer. He almost screwed it all up and gave everything away by being surprised, but he got it back with his offensive mindset.
You know, that's a great story right there. There's more to the whole thing, but that's it in a nutshell. Chris, thank you for that summary. Take a minute now and tell us about Battle Digest, because it's a real great option for people who want to learn more about our nation's battles.
Yes, I appreciate that, Danny. So my business now is producing historical summaries of these fantastic, interesting battles, and they're very concise. They're really executive summaries, and I hope your listeners would be interested in just checking it out by going to battledigest.com. Just type in battledigest.com in your web browser, see what it is, see what you think. And I think you'll love it. If you like history at all, or if you know someone who likes history, battledigest.com will be your best friend.
I totally agree with that. Chris, thank you for your service to our nation. Thank you for being a great part of the Front Lines of Freedom team. I really appreciate you, bro.
Thanks, Denny, and thanks for your service as always.
Troops, if you're a veteran who's having trouble getting their disability approved by the VA, contact Barry Law. Reach them at PTSDLawyers.com. That's PTSDLawyers.com. I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. Next up, it's time for our weekly mailbag. Then it's military history time. You reported for duty to Front Lines of Freedom. Stand tall, troops. Let's do some more push-ups. How about 60 this time? And once your ranger ready, then stand at ease.
$30 trillion in debt, 20 years of endless war, and veterans not able to get the care they deserve. These are some of the issues concerned Veterans for America is confronting head-on. At CVA, we aim to amplify the veteran perspective to create a better future for all Americans. But we need your help. Join CVA in shaping a better tomorrow for you, your family, and your community. Visit cv4a.org to learn more and join the movement. That's cv4a.org.
Do you have a story inside you yearning to come out? As a self-published author, you are free to creatively distribute your book online or using your own professional connections. White Feather Press will publish your manuscript and set up online distribution, allowing the author to retain all copyright and distribution rights as well as all profits. Check out White Feather Press at publishyourdream.com. White Feather Press, reaffirming faith in God, family, and country. I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. This is the final formation for this week on Front Lines of Freedom. Okay, team, it's mailbag time. I really welcome comments from you, our listeners. Do send your thoughts to me at denny@frontlinesoffreedom.com or on Facebook. Skip, what's the first one?
Well, Colonel, Marine vet Shannon was a bit annoyed by the comments made by the Blexit guy, but everything he said made sense.
Shannon, we won't all agree on anything involving race relations, but it's important that we can talk with and listen to each other. We're all Americans.
And Pete, a Navy vet and Navy dad, enjoyed the comments by the CO2 Coalition guy. He's always felt the global warming, climate change stuff was wrong. It was good to hear the science on the subject.
Pete, I agree. All we hear from the media is the inaccurate science about climate change. The climate has always been changing, just like it is now. Now it's time for military history. Take us there, Skip. What's the first one?
Well, Colonel, on 4 May 1864, during the Civil War, the Army of the Potomac embarked on the biggest campaign of the Civil War and crossed the Rapidan River in Virginia, precipitating an epic showdown and eventually decides the war. In March 1864, Ulysses Grant became commander of all the Union forces and devised a plan to destroy the two major remaining Confederate armies, Joseph Johnston's Army of the Tennessee, which was guarding the approaches to Atlanta, and Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia. Grant set William Sherman to take on Johnston, and then rode along with the Army of the Potomac, which was still under the command of George Meade, to confront Lee. On May 4, the Army of the Potomac moved out of its winter encampments and crossed the Rapidan River to the tangled woods of the Wilderness Forest. Grant had with him four corps and over 100,000 men. The plan was to move the Federal troops quickly around Lee's left flank and advance beyond the Wilderness before engaging the Confederates. But logistics slowed the move, and the long wagon train supplying the Union troops had to stop in the Wilderness. Although there was no combat on this day, the stage was set for the epic duel between Grant and Lee. In the dense environs of the Wilderness, the superior numbers of the Union army were minimized. Lee attacked the following day, the first salvo in the biggest campaign of the war. The fighting lasted into June as the two armies waltzed to the east of Richmond, Virginia, ending in Petersburg, where they settled into trenches and faced off for nearly 9 months.
Wow. On May 3rd, 1942, during World War II, that was the first day of the first modern naval engagement in history called the Battle of the Coral Sea. A Japanese invasion force occupied Tulagi of the Solomon Islands. We, having broken Japan's secret war code, thanks to an American of Japanese ancestry, were forewarned of the impending invasion. 4 days of battles between Japanese and American aircraft carriers resulted in 70 Japanese and 66 American warplanes destroyed. This marked the first air-naval battle in history, as none of the carriers fired on each other, allowing the planes flying from their decks to do the battle. Although Japan would go on to occupy all of the Solomon Islands, its victory was a Pyrrhic one. The cost in experienced pilots and aircraft carriers was so great that Japan had to cancel its expeditions to other South Pacific targets.
And on 2 May 1945, during World War II, approximately 1 million German soldiers laid down their arms as the terms of the German unconditional surrender, signed at Caserta on April 29, came into effect. Many Germans surrendered to Japanese soldiers, Japanese Americans. Among the American tank crews that entered the northern Italian town of Biella was an all-Nisei infantry battalion composed of Japanese Americans from Hawaii.
And that was the end of World War II in Europe, but it continued on in the Pacific. And on the 1st of May, 1960, during the Cold War, an American U-2 spy plane was shot down while conducting espionage over the Soviet Union. This derailed an important summit meeting between President Eisenhower and Soviet leader Khrushchev that was scheduled for later that month. The U-2 spy plane was the brainchild of the CIA, and it was a sophisticated technological marvel. Traveling at altitudes of up to 70,000 feet, the aircraft was equipped with state-of-the-art photography. Flights over the Soviet Union began in mid-1956. The CIA assured Eisenhower that the Soviets did not possess anti-aircraft weapons sophisticated enough to shoot down the high-altitude planes. And on May 1st, a U-2 piloted by Francis Gary Powers disappeared on a flight over Russia. The CIA reassured Eisenhower that even if the plane had been shot down, it was equipped with self-destruct mechanisms that would render any wreckage unrecognizable, and the pilot was instructed to kill himself. So we issued a cover statement that a weather plane had veered off course and supposedly crashed somewhere in Russia. Khrushchev produced not only the mostly intact wreckage of the U-2, but also the pilot, very much alive. A chagrined Eisenhower had to publicly admit it was our spy plane. The pilot, Francis Gary Powers, was released in 1962 in exchange for a captured Soviet spy.
And on 1 May 1972, North Vietnamese troops captured Quang Tri City, the first provincial capital taken during their ongoing offensive. This massive invasion by North Vietnamese forces was designed to win them the war. The attacking force included 14 infantry divisions with over 120,000 troops and about 1,200 tanks. The main North Vietnamese objectives were Con Tum in the central highlands and An Lac further to the south. Initially, the South Vietnamese defenders were overwhelmed in the northern provinces. At Con Tum and An Lac, the South Vietnamese were more successful, but only after weeks of bitter fighting. Although the defenders suffered heavy casualties, they held their own with the aid of U.S. advisors and American air power. Fighting continued all over South Vietnam into the summer months, and eventually the South Vietnamese forces prevailed. With the communist invasion blunted, President Nixon declared that the South Vietnamese victory proved the viability of his Vietnamization program, which he had instituted in 1969 to increase the combat capability of the South Vietnamese armed forces so U.S. troops could be withdrawn.
And that's military history for today. Now it's time for our self-defense report. Take us there, Skip.
All of us here at Frontlines of Freedom want our listeners to get trained and get armed in that order. We fully support the right to keep and bear arms for all law-abiding families, and we encourage you to find out about the laws governing use of deadly force in your state and follow them to the letter. And of course, don't forget to follow the rules of safety and common sense whenever you're carrying a firearm to protect the ones you love. What's the story this week, Colonel?
Well, hundreds and possibly as many as 1,000 teens converged on the Chicago Loop for Teen Takeover in response to social media posts about a planned gathering near Millennium Park. The mob of teenagers stormed the streets of downtown Chicago, smashing car windows, attacking bystanders, and sending panicked tourists running from the sounds of gunfire. Police say a 6-year-old boy was shot in the arm near the Chicago Loop, and a 17-year-old boy was shot in the leg. Both were taken to Northwest Hospital and listed in fair condition. Mayor-elect of Chicago Brandon Johnson responded with this comment, quote, "Our city must work together to create spaces for the youth to gather safely and reasonably under adult guidance and supervision to ensure that every part of our city remains welcome to both residents and visitors," end quote.
Thanks, Colonel. This is just one more example of liberal politicians gone wrong. Part of the woke ideology says that police are bad people and should be defunded. Chicago is routinely one of the most dangerous cities in America. In fact, nearly every Democrat-run large city in America is facing the same problem of out-of-control crime. I believe these teens already have a safe place to gather safely and responsibly. It's called their home or the public library. This is what happens when criminals are coddled and allowed to do whatever they want. I remember being a teenager and having some of the stupidest thoughts of my life run through my hormone-driven brain. The only thing that kept me from carrying out much of my idiocy was the fear of God and my own father, should I get caught. For many of these teens, the fear of God no longer exists because we are rapidly becoming a godless society. Many of them also don't have a strong father figure in their lives to hold them in check. Granted, they have a mom, but even a strong mother isn't enough to restrain a teenager unchained. This is going to happen more and more across the country. So let's take a look at some things you can do to minimize the damage to you and your family. First, don't travel to Chicago or any of the other big cities that allow crime to run rampant. It's really your best defense against big city crime, since the criminals seem to be a protected class. It's all backwards. The justice system used to protect the innocent and punish the guilty, but not anymore. Just get out of Dodge and stay out of Dodge. Second, if you have to go to the city, keep the local news channel turned on before and while you travel. Get some good intel and act on it. If you don't, you may naively blunder into a flash mob or even a full-blown riot. Third, if you get caught on the street during one of these events, escape as quickly as you can. If you can't, then seek shelter inside a large building with adequate security. Finally, you should always carry a gun, but many of these large cities disarm citizens carte blanche. Pepper spray is of little use against a mob of 1,000 teenagers. Even if you can legally carry a gun in the city, you may be charged criminally should you use the gun to defend yourself. I would not carry in today's woke America without adequate legal protection as well. This is now a must. Bottom line, folks, stay out of the big cities. They are just no longer safe for you and your family.
I wish that wasn't true, Skip, but surely it is. Our movie of the month is The Chinese Tutankhamun. We just reviewed it. You can go to the Frontlines of Freedom website, go to the blog and get the link. You can still watch it for free. Next week on Frontlines of Freedom, attorney Hadley Arkus will discuss his book on really understanding our Constitution. It's awesome. I've taught the Constitution, and I learned from that book. Then Air Force nurse Jason Gleason will present National Nurse Week. Judy Elias will share about Heroes to Heroes, helping hurting vets. And Chaplain Scott McChrystal will discuss his ministry in the military. Our book, Frontlines of Freedom, with 19 authors, has the mission of helping all patriotic Americans step up and help our nation return to our traditional values of serving, not being served, of being in shape physically, mentally, and morally, of being proud of our nation. And that book's available in Spanish now. You can purchase that book at frontlinesoffreedom.com. Please help us get this call to action book into the hands of all Americans.
Thank you, friends, for joining us for Frontlines of Freedom today and every week on this great station. Please check us out on Facebook and add your comments. And if you missed any part of this show, hey, all our shows are available on demand at frontlinesoffreedom.com. We especially thank our military listeners for serving our country with honor and dignity and for keeping us all safe. God bless you and your families as you serve.
I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. Thank you, listeners all across America, for joining us in the foxholes on the front lines of freedom. Stand tall. Be proud, Americans. And join me next week for military and veteran information you won't get anywhere else on the front lines of freedom. Dismissed.